Esther chapter 2. Esther 2. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done, and what was decreed against her. Then said the king's servants administered unto him, "Let there be fair young virgins sought for the king. Let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan, the palace, to the house of the women, under the custody of Hege, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women, and let their things for purification be given them. And let the maiden which pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti." And the thing pleased the king, and he did so. In the previous chapter, we had the Persian king in the midst of a great quasi-religious celebration, which is signaled to the readers of Esther by the description of the public garden, reminiscent of the tabernacle or the temple, that there's been a great preparation made. And now an event that was intended to ensnare the Jews and provoke the displeasure of their God, this event, this feast, has concluded itself by setting the stage for their very deliverance rather than their destruction. There's no power that can rise against the people of God without the permissive will of God. And unbeknownst to the heathen king, the wheels of providence are set against the Persian Empire, both within and without. Now, this great preparation for the deliverance of Israel can be traced in every lineament of what unfolds in the book of Esther. The rash anger of the king, whose heart is in the hand of the Lord, and he turns it whithersoever he will, that anger is moved to be pleased to enact an irrevocable law after the manner of the Persians and the Medes. This decree will result in the removal of a queen otherwise beloved, Vashti. This decree will assure at least two things. First, that she'll be deprived of all that pertains to the royal estate, including, as I've said, most likely, her life. Second, that all which pertains to that estate shall be bestowed upon another who will be deemed to be more worthy. Now, in this case, being more worthy indicates that she who takes Vashti's place must be at least equally beautiful, and that she's possessed of a much more submissive spirit to render obedience to her husband than was Vashti. After all, Vashti's offense was that she didn't yield obedience. Apparently, she didn't think it was necessary to give any reason for her insubordination. Now, this action of the queen became the pretext for what may be considered court intrigue, the plot to remove the queen. As I've mentioned, it's very unlikely that there was nothing that went before in all of this. It's very likely that there was a history here. Nonetheless, this particular event becomes the pretext upon which the scaffold of her removal will be accomplished. And so her removal is accomplished not openly, as it might have been, given that she likely had a very serious coterie of people who were not happy with her as queen. But it's moved now under the plausible guise that what might come of what she's done, this bad example, that this may set an example throughout the whole kingdom. That what she's done may infect all of the women of the kingdom. In fact, Mamukin suggests that this is going to lead to a general disregard of the authority of husbands throughout Persia. Now, we can debate the merits of the case, but at this time and at this point, given all that had transpired in the court, what Mamukin suggests, in fact, is going to carry enough weight to push the king to a course of action that otherwise he might not have been inclined to set into effect. Mamukin is saying this royal dispute, if left unpunished, is going to result in widespread marital and familial instability to the detriment of the king and his courtiers. Of course, right now, the only real marital instability is in the house of the king itself, as far as we know. But there may have been reason, even then, to conclude that this had already begun in the families, at least of those high-level officials who were closest to the king. And these were people who would have known and had intimate contact with the queen. Those wives of these officials would have attended her party for the women. So it's very likely that they're going to be, if not enticed by this example, at least intrigued by this example and watching very carefully to see what the outcome of this example would be. So, the solution that's given is a public removal of the queen and the publication of the downfall of her from her royal estate in order to secure domestic tranquility outside of the royal palace. Now, this thought is actually in keeping with an admonition which Solomon gives in Ecclesiastes 8, verse 11. He says, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. So there is some genuine concern here, legitimate concern, I should say, to see that what she's done does not become an example that others are going to follow. And there is concern, legitimate concern, that if there isn't something done, that other women are going to take this and perhaps think that they could get away with it too. So the idea is this removal of the queen has to be public, and it has to be published. It's not to be done in some dark corner, which again, I think favors the opinion of the rabbis that this actually ends with the execution of Vashti. Now, furthermore, for those who are afar off, news has to be carried by royal messenger and proclaimed by the royal herald in the various public squares of these 127 provinces so that none would lose the gravity of the matter. Everybody has to know that what she's done is unacceptable and that it has been, in fact, put down very hard. Now, I just want to say a note, or make a note here, that there are many, many things which are not explicitly brought into the story of Esther. There are a number of things that I've alluded to and I'm going to allude to which we know from profane histories. We know things about this story, things that are not in the Book of Esther. And yet, the Book of Esther ignores things which, in the eyes of the heathen world, are major events. Because the Book of Esther is not concerned so much with the destiny of the Persian Empire as it is concerned with the destiny of the people of God. So in all of this, we see God's concern for his word, the prophecies about the Persian Empire and his people. These things actually stand at the center of all of the providential motions in the world. And Esther tells us a story from a very different point of view than we find in the annals of heathen histories. Remember, there's a general providence respecting all of mankind, but as our confession very clearly indicates, there's a special providence respecting the church. And in Esther, this special providence is displayed in the various seeming minor details, as I've noted, which are placed all along our way. So, nowhere are we going to see a huge miracle, and yet everywhere in Esther, there is the making of a huge miracle. And that's what one of the things I think that makes Esther such an interesting and appealing book when we consider the providence of God in it. So in verse 1, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. After these things means when all had been accomplished. That is to say, when the king had taken the advice of Memucan in chapter 1, he had adopted his solution uncritically, evidently. The queen had been removed, as far as we know, and letters had been sent out in the whole of the Persian Empire so that all the people might know what had happened. Now a period of time, we're led to believe, it passed. In fact, we know from the account a period of time had passed. No longer was the setting a great wine feast, like in chapter 1. No longer do we have the king sitting in the midst of his courtiers in chapter 1, receiving all of this grand council. No longer is his judgment, in fact, impaired through these endless days of drinking. No longer are we faced with a king as he's strutting in the heights of his pride amidst the spoils of his conquests and his fawning and adoring subjects. The great Persian Empire was, at this point, at least for a time, quiet. And yet, not everything is quiet. When the entire empire goes quiet, the king himself, we see, is not quiet. Now, after these things, actually has to include the interval of several years. Several years wherein the Persians had gone out to attack the Greeks. In fact, it's apparent in verse 16 of this chapter that we've now moved from the third year of Xerxes to the seventh year of Xerxes. And this we know from Herodotus, the ancient historian. This we know is the year in which the Greek campaign ended, right around the year 480 or 479 BC. Having returned from the exhaustion of the war, They had had a terrible time at a place called Salamis. You can read about it. But the Persians had not bested the Greeks on the battlefield, and this is really a turning point for them. It's really setting the stage for what's going to follow with the rise of Alexander and the increase of the Greek Empire overtaking the Persian Empire. There's an eclipse that's about to occur here, and yet all of that is ignored in the Book of Esther, as important as that may seem. But Ahasuerus, Xerxes, as he's known in history, he's now returned, and he's in a very different frame of mind than he was when he was going off to war. Now, going into war, he was very keen to make sure that there was no insubordination in the empire. His decree regarding Vashti was really a decree that had arisen from these councils of war. His counselors, by all accounts, had actually encouraged him to anticipate easy victory. But these anticipations of easy victory and the elation associated with the earlier festivities have given way to the new reality that these upstart Greeks have actually beaten back the Persians. Herodotus, as I say, in his history of the Persians, the Persian Wars, he tells us that after this defeat, Xerxes has turned himself inward, and he's turned himself to a variety of sensual comforts. In fact, it's really this catastrophe of foreign policy that leads him to make a number of ill-fated decisions, because during this time it's said he had several affairs with the wives of his officers, and that left a very bitter taste in the mouths of some and paved the way for his assassination a few years later in 465 BC. So if you're wondering what happened in the period of time the 3 years transpired, we know from the heathen histories, this is a time when the Persians went out to fight against the Greeks and really were bested on the battlefield, and they return, and now the king, exhausted, finds himself coming home to an empty house, because after all, in the course of his war councils and his inflamed passions, he removed his beloved queen and in all likelihood had her executed. So after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, we're told clearly now, no longer was the king moved by anger. And the word for appeasement here is a word that's used to describe the receding of a flood. The word appeased indicates a lessening, as of the subsiding of a river after it's overflowed its banks. The point is that a lot had happened, and time and event had covered over that earlier sense of wrath that he had. This clause suggests his anger lasted long after the effects of the wine had dissipated, but not 3 years. Yet the passage of time and the less than hoped for outcome in the Greek campaign, it's pretty likely that altogether this had dampened the wrath of the king. When things are going that poorly in your world, it's very easy to allow that to overtake all of the other sensations. And so the wrath of the king, we're told, had run its course. And interestingly, knowing the history, it actually seems that it had run its course against the Greeks and against his wife, and now it's subsided. So when the wrath of the king Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti. In all of this, it appears somehow, in the mind of the king, the events surrounding the removal of Vashti, the outcome of the Greek campaign, are connected. And that's indicated, again, by what we're told by Herodotus, as well, I think, as what is indicated in the Hebrew in the Book of Esther. Now, as I mentioned when commenting on the previous chapter, these two things were, in fact, intertwined. Because the same counselors which had encouraged him in that ill-fated Greek campaign were the same people who were also involved in counseling him in the matter of the queen. Now, by our text, referring to her simply as Vashti, I think we're reminded of the deep love that the king must have had for her. The idea here is that he thought first upon her person and his affection for her. He's moved by that memory, probably especially in light of the Greek campaign, which had very clearly humbled all of his earthly pride. Again, the language here and following, I think, still favors the notion that Vashti was beyond any possibility of rehabilitation, that she had, in fact, been killed. He remembered her. He thought upon her. All that she is now is a memory. He remembered Vashti and what she had done. Now, that's very interesting, the order here, I think, because under the influence of wine and passion, the king had thought first about what Vashti had done, refusing to come before him. And then, only secondarily, did he think about her. But now he thinks first of her and of all that she meant to him. And it's only after his mind has been filled with these kinds of thoughts of her that he moves to consider again what she's done. What was it that she did? And perhaps now, given that change in perspective, given the change in worldly status, even having suffered this defeat at the hands of the Greeks, perhaps now he would have decided the whole matter differently. Perhaps now he would have been more inclined to discover all of the mitigating circumstances necessary to spare her. It doesn't really matter, however, at this point, because the fact is that it was not to be. Whatever the outcome, it was, in fact, irrevocable. And so he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. All the second thinking was of no use. The fact is that a decree, an unalterable command, had gone forth concerning her. And this decree of the king, although the source of his present discomfort, was not something that was able to be reversed. Again, I think that this leads us to a point where we should at least lend credence to that rabbinic opinion which asserts that Vashti was executed. Because undoubtedly, given the king's new state of mind, if there was some means, any means, of reversing or nullifying that decree, I think, given the pathos in this verse, he would have done all that he could to do so. We should remember, by the way, not only was the decree of the king against Vashti, but ultimately, as we understand throughout this book, the decree of God was as well. It was necessary, remember, it was necessary for Vashti to be taken away with no hope of being recovered, so that Esther might rise in her stead. Or as the apostle says in Romans, all things work together for good for those who are the called of God. So, verse 2. Then said the king's servants administered unto him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king. Then said the king's servants. Note the contrast with chapter 1. Now in the quiet of the royal residence, out of the view of the public, away from those courtiers that attended him, at least in his war councils, the king now receives advice, and he's getting this advice in a very different context. Those who speak to him are those who we are led to believe from the words used here are those who attend upon him in his privacy. These are the people before whom the king very obviously has displayed his discomfort and the unhappiness at the present circumstances of his life. They see him in private commiserating over the loss of his wife. It's those who occupy the inner chamber who knew best the present mindset of the king at this time. These are really his servants, not his courtiers. They're not men who've been assembled for the purpose of giving advice. These are not men who've been gathered with the purpose of helping him rule and reign. These are probably men of a common station in life. These are not men who are of superior intellect. They don't need to know military strategy. They don't need to know what is and is not in the annals of history. These people need to know how to do simple things like making his bed and preparing his clothing. Again, we see the hand of God moving the decisions of the king. Now, those who are surrounding him in his residence are not going to give the kind of advice befitting Ahasuerus as a king. But the fact is, they do understand his common needs as a man. Then said the king's servants administered unto him. Again, emphasis is on the fact that they ministered unto him, and that underscores that they are men of common station. Their advice is not going to be filled with what we call realpolitik, or political intrigue of any kind. These are not guys who are concerned with the machinations of government. Right? They're not the kind of people who would have been involved in making that kind of decision that would have removed the queen in the first instance. These are men who are concerned with the private, creaturely comforts of the king. Their concerns then are more practical and local. They understand what men desire. And they understand, in fact, what men most cherish in a wife. These aren't guys who are concerned about the potential queen's pedigree, or her manners, or her ability in political affairs. They're not thinking like that. Their advice, therefore, is limited to what they perceive to be the immediate problem and its solution. And it just so happens that at this time, the king is ready to take precisely that kind of advice. Let there be fair young virgins sought for the king. Now, advising the king to choose a wife without consideration of her background, without any reference to her station in life, in terms of royal estate, this should seem preposterous. No one in their right mind who would be in the court of the king advising in matters of state would be advising this kind of thing. But these servants are placed precisely at that point wherein they're able to offer just that kind of advice and overthrow all of the counsels of the wise. They offer advice which is designed in the providence of God to allow for the consideration and ultimately for the choice of Esther. The sole criteria for choice was what? We have to be beautiful virgins. Married women were excluded. Besides, as I noted before, that had already gotten the king into some trouble, and it was going to lead him into more trouble and to his untimely end. But just as Vashti had been of noted beauty, the queen, the new queen, she also has to meet this standard. So this is a standard upon which Esther is going to be brought into the royal palace. Verse 3. Let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace, to the house of the women, under the custody of Hegi, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women, and let their things for purification be given them. Let the king appoint officers. These young men who were giving private advice in the king's inner chamber continue. They don't just stop, but they're going to tell the king how they think this ought to be accomplished, right? In order to find all the fairest virgins, they say, let the king appoint officers. And the search for a royal wife should be made a priority within the kingdom. We need special people, special appointments. So it's important should be attended with the appointment of men to be officers whose mission will be to find the most beautiful woman to replace Vashti. That's their goal. They don't care about her education. They don't care about her pedigree. They don't care about anything else. They don't care about any other possible thing that she may or may not bring to the table. She needs to be a beautiful woman. The king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom. Remember, the officers and that are being appointed, they're being appointed over all the provinces, all the territories of the empire, all 127, which means that there were at least 127 of these people who were appointed to go out and find the most beautiful, the most eligible women for the king. And the search, interestingly enough, is not limited to the Persians or the Medes. Normally, you might think that it would have been limited. You don't necessarily want one of these conquered people having one of their daughters next to the king. In terms of realpolitik, that is not going to be necessarily the best kind of advice, but this is not a normal search for a wife. It's really a beauty contest. And it's a beauty contest which is going to be made to reach to the farthest points of the Persian Empire. The search is to be for a woman who is the fairest, a virgin, who's going to please the king. One whose beauty is such that it would drive away the memories of Vashti from troubling the king anymore. She's got to be pretty enough to dispel all of the memories of the previous queen. So let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins. Now these officers were charged with finding all the young women who were both fair and virgins. Which tells us a couple of things. Not all young women are fair, and not all fair women are virgins. But the king was, in this manner, seeking a beautiful young woman who had attained meritable age. Wanted someone who was marriageable age. These officers appointed then had to be men who at least at some level had some notion of what was pleasing to the king. But they had to know what it was they were seeking to some degree. Now, the Jews actually on this place note the contrast here with King David when he was seeking a virgin in 1 Kings 1, 2 through 4. Wherefore his servant said unto him, let there be sought for my lord the king a young virgin, and let her stand before the king, and let her cherish him, and let her lie in thy bosom, that my lord the king may get heat. So they sought for a fair damsel throughout all the coasts of Israel, and found Abishag, a Shunammite, and brought her to the king. And the damsel was very fair, and cherished the king, and ministered to him, but the king knew her not. Now, I note that in the case of David, they didn't really need officers because men voluntarily brought their daughters forward to be with David. In the case of Ahasuerus, however, the people were inclined to hide their daughters because they knew that his screening process was one wherein these women would become defiled, and it would leave all of them but one unfit for marriage. So, there's a difference. And there's, as we'll see, I think we have to remember that the Jews themselves are going to be forced to contend with this order of the king as well. That they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace. These young women, as they were found, were to be brought to Shushan, to the palace. Now, again, notice that the same summer palace wherein the intrigue concerning Vashti occurred is where this drama is made to continue. And remember as well that all of this is actually transpiring in Mordecai's backyard, where he's going to be able to give counsel to Esther without any inconvenience to that prophet of God. Consider that although these officers would scour the backwoods of the empire to find a replacement for Vashti, the appointed replacement was already near the king. Actually, she's already in the vicinity of the palace. So, he's sending out into these 127 provinces, but the one who's appointed to take Vashti's place is really in his backyard. Here again, then, we see the superintending hand of God, the providential concern for the people of God, which brought Esther even to that place for that time. And we'll see this again and again. That they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace to the house of the women. The house of the women is a phrase which connotes the harem. It's a separate place that was devoted to the use of women. Now in verse 14 of this chapter, we can see already this harem consisted of more than one building. This is a site where Vashti had conducted her separate feast for the women while the men were in the courtyard in chapter 1. It almost certainly had several buildings that were likely designated for different uses. Now, usually there was a house for the queen. We see such a thing Solomon built for the daughter of Pharaoh in 1 Kings 7, verse 8. And his house where he dwelt had another court within the porch, which was of the like work. Solomon made also an house for Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had taken to wife like unto this porch. So, there was then the house of virgins, which is mentioned in verse 9 of this chapter, beside the house where the queen was kept. It would be her house. And finally, there's the house where the chamberlains would keep the concubines, which was called the second house of women in verse 14. So that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace, to the house of the women, under the custody of Hege, the king's chamberlain. Literally, the Hebrew here says, into the hand of Hege. Because entrusting them into his hand means, idiomatically, to place them under his immediate authority as belonging to him, as being under his immediate charge. Thus, it's translated as being placed in his custody. Because he has a custodianship or a guardianship over them. His duty is to see that they're protected and nurtured. The name Hege signifies eunuch. Rather than a proper name, it should be understood to be the title of the chief amongst these eunuchs. Its variant spelling in later verses, you can see that in later verses in this chapter, is reflected in the Greek of the Septuagint, where the name Hege clearly signifies a title rather than a proper name. The term translated chamberlain refers to a class of royal officials. The officials who pertain to the king are characterized by being one of those made subject to castration. Now, what's interesting is this. Herodotus tells us that hundreds of Persian boys were gathered and castrated each year to serve in the Persian court. Hege, then, is the title of the chief eunuch, the one who would oversee the other court eunuchs and, as is apparent, has the primary authority in the house of the women. But lest we think that the Persians were only mistreating girls in bringing all these fair young virgins to this place, we need to remember that at the same time, they were gathering young boys from all over the empire and castrating them to be eunuchs serving in this court. So the Persians were equal opportunity offenders against gender. that they may gather together all the fair young virgins under Shushan the palace to the house of the women, under the custody of Hegi the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women. Now, here, as by way of emphasis, I think he's denominated the keeper of women. The word keeper in Hebrew actually denotes one that's charged with a careful guardianship, one who is charged with enacting a defense around these women. His job consisted, in some sense, in setting boundaries between these women and the rest of the court. He's the gatekeeper. So no one passes to the house of women without his approval, and no one comes forth from the house of women without his approval. He's it. What he says is law. He must assure that the women were being maintained in chastity as they awaited the pleasure of the king. If any woman showed up, having been brought a virgin into the palace, and she gets to the king and she's not a virgin, it's going to be Hegi that is going to suffer the consequences of that. They may gather together all the fair young virgins under Shushan the palace to the house of the women under the custody of Hegi the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women, and let their things for purification be given them. So these women were to be collected from the far reaches of the empire, gathered under the hand of a single authority in the palace of Shushan, and there they were placed in the house of women with very little fanfare. However, each of these women was to be given various ointments, perfumes, and other cosmetics which they required in order to make themselves more attractive to the king. Remember, the contest before them is a beauty contest, and each woman is going to want to avail herself of whatever helps she could find. There could only be a single winner, and that would be the one who managed to attract the king's attention to the exclusion of all the other women. So they're eager to get their hands on these things for purification. Literally, this term means cosmetics. They're interested in cosmetics. So we see the real end for cosmetics is simply to attract men, not a high recommendation. And we'll see what the queen, or we'll see what Esther does with that later on. Anyhow, the fourth verse, let the maiden which pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti. And the thing pleased the king, and he did so. Let the maiden which pleaseth the king. Here's the end for which these women were gathered, that one might be found who would be pleasing to the king. Literally, the Hebrew speaks of her being pleasing in his eyes. Again, it's not a contest of personality. It's not who has the best personality. It's not who's the smartest woman. It's not an intelligence contest. Not particularly interested in any other talents that this woman may or may not have. Simply this. She needs to be at least as pretty as Vashti. Remember then, this search has been conducted along far more carnal lines than is befitting the search for a queen. The criteria for choosing these women includes these things. They're young, they're virgins, they're pretty. There's not much that's been demanded beyond those things. And ultimately, by the way, the winner, we're told, is going to be determined now by the eye of the king. So these guys who are sent out, these officers, they may be narrowing it down, but ultimately it's, do you please the king? Matters very little what others think. If the king takes pleasure in one girl, one particular girl, she will prevail. Let the maiden which pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti. So although the girls, as they're being gathered, they might have thought themselves competing with one another. But this clause reminds us, I think, that the real contest is going to be, how does she measure up with the previous queen, Vashti, particularly in the looks department? So we see the entirety of this process is being driven by the memory of Vashti. And what makes this, I think, even more difficult is this memory of Vashti has taken on a certain nostalgic quality. See, it's not just a remembrance of Vashti, it's a nostalgic remembrance of her. The prize for satisfying the king's desire to replace his former beautiful spouse is going to be to ascend to the rank of royalty and be queen in her stead. Not just going to be queen for a day, you're going to be queen for life. And we're told the thing pleased the king. So these private servants in their private capacity have seen the personal unhappiness of the king. Now we see the plan of those who ministered to the king in this setting was one that appealed to his present mindset. At any point, he might have refused hearing this, but no. And behold again how a plan so ill-befitting a king is adopted at this point so uncritically by this Persian monarch. But we have to remember, the heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord, and he's turning it whithersoever he will. Had a normal course been followed, had a normal counsel been sought, it is highly unlikely that Esther could have met the requirements of that kind. They would have looked, they would have found out she was a Jew. Even if she was beautiful enough, that would have been enough under normal circumstances to disqualify her entirely. However, we must remember the plan of God must prevail. And all things are subordinated to the special providence that God is exercising toward his church. So we read, the thing pleased the king, and he did so. Ahasuerus is moved by the proposed plan to follow the advice of his personal servants to the letter. He doesn't need any additional cajoling or convincing. He likes the plan, hears it, and immediately it strikes him as something that has great merit. Solves his problem. He's lonely. He misses his wife. Again, it's amazing to note how quickly he's persuaded to follow their counsel rather than even submitting this to any level of review with any other counsel, real counsel, like that of his courtiers. Yet, as I've noted, it's probably at least in part due to the great personal disappointment that he feels with the advice of his courtiers. His unhappiness, both in the military field and now at home, are the result of a lot of bad advice these guys have given him. And there are several things I think we can observe in our story thus far. First of all, very often we think those people to be most happy who have the least restraints in life. Now, Ahasuerus was an absolute monarch. He really ruled without much restraint, and that was part of the problem, wasn't it? In his case, we can see how much better it is to have counsel, particularly godly counsel. But more than that, it would have been great for him if there had been some sort of restraint. He needed someone who would have been able to restrain him from accomplishing the desires of his will in the moment of passion. You know, it's bad to be subjected to bad counsel. But it's even worse, isn't it, to be abandoned to our own unrestrained passions. And when there's nothing that can restrain you, when you are left to your own devices, when you live your life uncounseled, that's bad. But when you live your life unrestrained, it's even worse. And that's what's happened. The king now has reached this point because of an unrestrained moment of passion. Now the king is presented with an opportunity to reflect upon the result of an impassioned moment, which has forever changed his life. And what happens? We're told here, he remembers Vashti. He remembers her company. He remembers the comfort that she once yielded him. And undoubtedly, as he thinks about this, he's brought to meditate upon his own folly in what's transpired. And that, too, is probably why he's so eager to take whatever advice he can find to remove this angst from him. Her memory has become sweet. That's what nostalgia does. But his own cruelty of conduct in the matter is now straining at his ease. He's got to live with it. But note again, with what ease the Lord exerts control over this situation. In setting that is here apart from the public gaze, which we're told what's happening here really by the inspiration of God. These private servants, whose normal functions were fixed upon private comforts of the king, suddenly find that their counsel has been propelled to the forefront of the king's agenda. Somehow, these lowly private servants are giving counsel, serious counsel, to the king. We never know, then, when we're going to be called upon to speak to kings. We have no idea. So we ought to be prepared for that. These guys were not prepared. Not in any conventional sense. How much better would it have been for the kingdom of Persia had these private servants been true believers and given godly counsel? The fact is this, the Lord had appointed this counsel to prevail. And so it's offered in this setting without any contrary or contending counsel, at a time and in a place and in a manner most fit to prevail. And that, too, demonstrates the hand of God over all things. Consider as well that all of the splendor of the Persian throne, to be the ruler of a great empire, it can't quench the longing of the king when he's faced with what is now a big void in his life. It's emptiness that he has in his life. The favors of court and the bounty of country cannot satisfy what is missing since Vashti was removed from the throne. Because man was made for communion with God and with one another, particularly that union and communion of husband and wife. A good wife is from the Lord. And how much better would he have been if he had had a good wife to begin with? But now, for the sake of the people of God, the Lord will make sure that he has a good wife. In all of this, we see the people are not going to be so forward to accomplishing this plan as would be hoped. And so, as I noted earlier, officers had to be appointed for each province to gather these girls. I mean, no right-thinking parent would be willing to place their daughter in the running for queen, knowing that failure brought certain doom and consignment to the harem in a degraded condition of servitude for the rest of your life. It's if you fail. And everybody but one is going to fail. But you see, the fact is this. In every nation, the people of the nation must pay for the indiscretion of their king. Whether it's military folly, like in Greece, or it's the kind of folly we see that erupted in the home of the king in the case of Vashti due to his domestic dispute. And even the Jews, because they're a captured people, they're going to suffer under this humiliating search. Their daughters are also going to be impressed into the service of the king unless they intervene and hide them. Of course, we remember they did hide their sons from the hands of Pharaoh. It's very likely they're going to do so again here. And that might seem to be highly detrimental to the possibility of a Jewess becoming the queen. And under normal circumstances, it would. But in this case, it can't. So for the righteous Jews, such as Mordecai, the search is not only not going to pose any inconvenience, it's going to bring all of the events of the kingdom to a conclusion for which they fasted and prayed, the deliverance of Israel from her enemies. And note that the use of cosmetics, creams, ointments, pigments, other preparatives for cleansing and scouring of the flesh emphasize the carnality of the gathering of these women. Any natural deformity or bodily incongruity is to be covered or hidden through the careful application of cosmetics. This is a beauty contest to fill the room of the queen. It has little concern with other qualifications for a wife. How different is the concern here than that which the concern of the court eunuchs from that which the Apostle Paul gives us in 1 Timothy 2, when he says, to women in like manner also, women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with shamefacedness and sobriety, not with broidered hair or gold or pearls or costly array, but which becometh women professing godliness with good works. And yet even this very shallow consideration in this case, for beauty is fleeting, even this shallow consideration shall be made to serve the purposes of God. Everything in this book is made to serve God's purposes. So, from the hollowest reasons of men, God shall accomplish his purposes. And in the book of Esther, once more we see it's not the vast intrigues of nations, it's not the war against Greece that occupies the attention of the reader here, as important as that is in the transference of empire. prophetically speaking. It's the quiet and more private moments wherein a series of seemingly insignificant events are made to bring forth the broader designs of providence. Finally, we see here the pleasure of a heathen king, a pleasure which is moved by little more than base concerns. You know, nothing is a surer sign of our reigning depravity than this, that we prefer pleasing our flesh to the pleasing of God. The king here has made it his desire to fulfill the desires, or made it his business to fulfill the desires of the flesh. But that's no impediment to the true God. And so it is that just as in his decree to remove Vashti, the plan of God is working, here in his accepting of the advice of these private servants, we see the will of the king showing forth itself to be a harbinger of the will of God. Because God worketh all things after the counsel of his own will. And so even the pleasure of a pagan king must carry the outworking of the providence of God and his forwardness to do his own pleasure, in this case, will actually ensure the special providence of God toward his church. And that, again, is the miracle of Esther. Yeah.